I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. From New York, this is Democracy Now!
This decision means that states can essentially target women who are on Medicaid, poor women, and cut off their access to all forms of reproductive health care, including contraception and STI testing.
The Supreme Court backs South Carolina in defunding Planned Parenthood by removing its health clinics from Medicaid. This comes 3 years after the court overturned Roe v. Wade. We'll speak to Rebecca Grant, author of Access, Inside the Abortion Underground, and the 60-year battle for reproductive freedom. Then to the case of Andre Jose Hernandez Romero, a gay makeup artist and asylum seeker from Venezuela, who spent over 100 days locked up in El Salvador's mega prison, Seca, after being sent there by the Trump administration. We'll speak to his mother.
Andre last called me on March 14th at 6:30 in the afternoon, telling me he was coming home, that they were going to transfer him to another detention center in Texas, where the plane was going to bring them to Venezuela. The plane was carrying all of the other innocent young men, but the plane didn't come here. It was sent to El Salvador.
We'll also speak to Andre's best friend, who just tried to see him in El Salvador, but was barred, and to Democratic Congressmember Pramila Jayapal. Then we remember Bill Moyers, the legendary PBS broadcaster and former White House aide, has died at the age of 91.
Well, the consensual seduction of the mainstream media by and with the government is one of the most dangerous toxins at work in America today.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Doctors in Gaza say Israeli attacks have killed at least 72 people over the past 24 hours. Among the dead, 6 people killed by Israeli forces near an aid distribution point north of Rafah, operated by the militarized U.S.-Israeli-backed Gaza Humanitarian Foundation. Meanwhile, Gaza's health ministry reports some 17,000 Palestinian children are suffering from acute malnutrition and are at risk of death. This is Mohammed Tabasha, a doctor in Gaza City, who says Israel's blockade of humanitarian aid, including milk and infant formula, is causing babies to starve.
The lack of milk affects the baby's weight. The baby does not grow fast, and hunger may affect the immunity of the baby, whereby one could easily become infected. And if his immunity is not strengthened, we may lose some babies due to a lack of available milk, especially the specialized formula that is no longer available from the health ministry.
On Capitol Hill, senior intelligence officials held a classified briefing Thursday for all 100 senators about President Trump's airstrikes on Iran's nuclear sites. Notably absent from the briefing was Trump's director of national intelligence, Tulsi Gabbard, who told Congress in March the intelligence community, quote, continues to assess Iran is not building a nuclear weapon, unquote. Last week, Gabbard walked back that assessment after Trump said she was wrong. Connecticut Democratic Senator Chris Murphy spoke to reporters after emerging from Thursday's closed-door briefing, warning Iran remains capable of rapidly producing a nuclear weapon.
You cannot bomb knowledge out of existence. No matter how many scientists you kill, there are still people in Iran who know how to work centrifuges. And if they still have enriched uranium, and they still have the ability to use centrifuges, then you're not setting back the program by years. You're setting back the program by months. The only path forward is diplomacy.
On Thursday, the White House said U.S. diplomats had no plans to meet their Iranian counterparts, walking back Trump's claims a day earlier of a meeting scheduled for next week. The White House says it's reached an agreement with China to speed imports of rare earth elements as the Trump administration seeks to unwind its trade war with Beijing. Earlier today, China's Commerce Ministry confirmed it had agreed to the framework of a new deal that'll see the U.S. drop restrictive measures in exchange for access to minerals used in cars, semiconductors, and smartphones. Senate Republicans are scrambling to save President Trump's massive package of tax cuts for the wealthy and cuts to social programs, dubbed the One Big Beautiful Bill Act. On Thursday, the Senate parliamentarian ruled Republican efforts to change how states can tax Medicaid providers makes the legislation ineligible for passage by a simple majority. The ruling opens the door to a filibuster by Democrats. In a 6-3 ruling, the U.S. Supreme Court has sided with South Carolina to defund Planned Parenthood by removing its health clinics from the state's Medicaid program. Writing for the dissent, Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson said the ruling's, quote, likely to result in tangible harm to real people. She said, quote, it will strip those South Carolinians and countless other Medicaid recipients around the country of a deeply personal freedom, the ability to decide who treats us at our most vulnerable, unquote. We'll have more on this ruling after headlines. Separately, the Supreme Court stayed the execution of a condemned Texas prisoner Thursday, mere minutes before he was scheduled to die by lethal injection. Ruben Gutierrez insists he was wrongfully convicted of a 1998 murder in Brownsville, Texas. He'll now have a chance to obtain DNA testing that he says will prove his innocence. Advocates are condemning widespread racial profiling as Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, continues to carry out mass raids nationwide, with mounting cases of U.S. citizens being rounded up as well. In Los Angeles, the family of Andrea Velez, a U.S. citizen, described her arrest by ICE earlier this week as a kidnapping. Velez had just been dropped off at work by her mom and sister when the pair witnessed masked federal agents grabbing and taking Velez in an unmarked car during an immigration raid. One video shows a masked agent lifting Velez from the ground and carrying her away. Velez's sister, Estrella Rosa, spoke with CBS News Los Angeles.
They didn't have a vest that said ICE or anything. Their cars didn't have license plates. Just because of the color of our skin, they think that we're criminals. My sister was there, so they she looks Hispanic, so let's take her too.
Andrea Velez was released Thursday on bond, accused of attempting to prevent an ICE arrest. In a similar case, Adrian Andrew Martinez, a 20-year-old U.S. citizen from the Los Angeles area, has been released from federal detention after he was violently arrested in a Walmart parking lot last week. Martinez was taken when he approached a group of heavily armed and masked federal agents who were detaining a Latino janitor at the shopping center where Martinez worked at a local Walmart. The agents attacked Martinez, threw him to the ground, arrested him as they asked him for proof he was born in the United States. Martinez has since been fired by Walmart. His body's still covered in cuts and bruises. He's wearing a knee brace after being injured by agents in the attack. In California, a bill introduced by two Bay Area lawmakers would force ICE agents and other federal agents to show their faces and identify themselves while making arrests. New York Congresswoman Nydia Velazquez has introduced similar legislation on Capitol Hill. On Wednesday, Attorney General Pam Bondi told lawmakers she was unaware that ICE agents are using masks and hoods to obscure their identity during immigration raids. She was questioned by Michigan Democratic Senator Gary Peters.
They have to identify themselves as law enforcement. People think, here's a person coming up to me, not identified, covering themselves. They're kidnapping. They'll probably fight back. That endangers the officer as well. Someone's going to fight back if you just think a strange person with their face covered throwing you into a van. Most people will resist that.
It sounds like you have a specific case, and I would
be happy
to talk to you about that at a later time because I'm not aware of that happening.
In more immigration news, a federal judge granted a request from the Trump administration to force-feed an Iranian asylum seeker who's on hunger strike while detained at the Florence ICE jail in Arizona. Last month, Mirat Asadi Edavand was arrested by federal immigration agents outside his home in Phoenix. He's been on two hunger strikes since. In Florida, another person has been reported dead in the custody of ICE. Johnny Noviello, a 49-year-old citizen of Canada, was found unresponsible at the Bureau of Prisons Federal Detention Center in Miami Monday. Noviello is at least the 10th person to die in ICE custody this year. Last week, a 68-year-old Mexican immigrant died while being transported from a local Georgia jail to an ICE detention center. Abelardo Avellaneda Delgado is the first person to die under these circumstances in at least a decade, according to The Guardian, as private companies are tasked with transporting immigrants with little oversight to ensure their safety. In public health news, a U.S. vaccine advisory panel has recommended adults and children no longer receive flu vaccines containing trace amounts of the mercury-containing compound known as thimerosal. That's despite the widespread scientific consensus that the preservative poses no risk to human health and does not cause autism, as a discredited 1998 study claimed. Thursday's decision by the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices came after Health and Human Services Secretary RFK Jr. fired the panel's 17 voting members and replaced them with hand-picked appointees, many of them anti-vaxxers. New York City Mayor Eric Adams announced Thursday he's running for re-election in November as an independent. Adams will face frontrunner Zoran Mamdani, a Democratic socialist who defeated former New York Governor Andrew Cuomo in Tuesday's Democratic mayoral primary. CNN reports Cuomo will not drop out of the race by today's deadline to remove himself from the general election ballot. Instead, Cuomo's name will appear under a ballot line for a newly created third party named Fight and Deliver. And the legendary journalist Bill Moyers has died at the age of 91. In the 1960s, Moyers was a founding organizer of the Peace Corps, served as press secretary for President Lyndon Johnson. In 1971, he began an award-winning career as a television broadcaster that would last for over 40 years. During that time, Moyers received over 30 Emmys and countless other prizes. He was elected to the Television Hall of Fame in 1995. Bill Moyers was a frequent guest on Democracy Now!, including this appearance in 2011.
Democracy should be a break on unbridled greed and power, because capital, like a fire, can turn from a servant, a good servant, into an evil master. And democracy is the break on my passions and my appetites and your greed and your wealth. And we have to get that equilibrium back.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In a 6-3 ruling, the Supreme Court's backed efforts by South Carolina to defund Planned Parenthood by removing its health clinics from the state's Medicaid program. In a dissent joined by her liberal colleagues, Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson said the ruling, quote, will strip those South Carolinians and countless other Medicaid recipients around the country of a deeply personal freedom, the ability to decide who treats us at our most vulnerable, unquote. Vicki Ringer of Planned Parenthood South Carolina spoke outside the Supreme Court Thursday.
Now, the governor has said, there's so many other Medicaid providers. We know that's a fallacy. There are not. We have a dire shortage of Medicaid providers. When the governor first issued this executive order in 2018, we scrambled to find other providers who would care for our patients. What we found was there was no one who would see a patient in less than 3 months. Well, if you've got a problem, 3 months is unacceptable. So who are they going to go to? Meanwhile, the state is sending money to these anti-abortion clinics that provide no health care whatsoever. But the main reason that they've done this is clearly political. They want to shut down Planned Parenthood, and they want to have a backdoor ban for abortion.
The ruling comes 3 years after the court overturned Roe v. Wade, eliminating the federal constitutional right to abortion. We're joined now in Washington, D.C. by Rebecca Grant, author and freelance journalist covering reproductive rights, health and justice. Her new book, Just Out, is titled Access, Inside the Abortion Underground and the 60-Year Battle for Reproductive Freedom. Before we talk about the resistance to what's taken place, I'd like you to respond to the Supreme Court's decision and its significance.
Yeah, I think it is yet another example in a very long line of anti-abortion politicians taking actions that we know will directly harm women and people who can get pregnant, and particularly people who are poor, who are low income, who have very limited options for how else they can access the health care that they so badly need. I mean, South Carolina, as the representative from Planned Parenthood mentioned, I think it's 41 out of 46 counties are considered federally designated health care provider shortage areas. So it's extremely unclear where people need to go. And this is in a state that already has very high rates of maternal mortality and of STIs. And so it's part of this broader effort to cut down on all reproductive health care and not just abortion access.
And talk about what this means for other states around the country. This is South Carolina.
The kind of term that I have been hearing is this idea that it will open the floodgates. There are already a handful of other states that have taken steps to, essentially kick Planned Parenthood off of Medicaid. This is also something that anti-abortion politicians have been trying to do in one form or another since at least 2015. And so I think it's extremely likely that we're going to see many states move to make similar moves or advance the moves that they've already made. And that could result in the closure of hundreds, potentially, of reproductive healthcare clinics. And this is on top of other moves that the administration is making to make this type of healthcare more difficult to access.
In 2023, the first lawsuit after the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade was filed by five women who sued Texas after they were denied abortions, even as their pregnancies posed serious risks to their health and were non-viable. This week, 3 years later, about 100, as they call them, abortion storytellers, came to Washington, D.C. to tell their stories. One of them was the plaintiff in that case, Amanda Zurofsky.
I cannot adequately put into words the trauma and despair that comes with waiting to either lose your own life, your child's life, or both. For days, I was locked in this bizarre and avoidable hell. In a matter of minutes, I went from being physically healthy to developing sepsis, a condition in which bacteria in the blood develops into infection with the ability to kill in under an hour.
So that was Amanda Zurofsky, who was speaking then a while ago, but today is in Washington, D.C., telling her story again. Rebecca Grant, this takes us to the resistance. Certainly, Amanda is one of the leaders in that resistance. But you write about this in this remarkable book, Access, Inside the Abortion Underground and the 60-Year Battle for Reproductive Freedom. Can you talk about, on the one hand, the Supreme Court overturning Roe v. Wade, but the fact that abortions have increased since the overturning of Roe v. Wade, even in some of the most repressive states when it comes to abortion bans in the country? Explain what's going on.
Yeah, I think that that statistic speaks to the incredible resilience and bravery and, frankly, creativity of the abortion access movement. And so while Dobbs is absolutely, there have been dire consequences, at the same time, I think that there is a way that the movement has stepped up to ensure that anyone who needs an abortion is able to get one. And so some of the reasons for the increase, and by the way, that increase does not include numbers of self-managed abortion, which there is also research showing that those numbers have gone up, that more people are self-managing their abortion, like outside of the medical or legal system. But I think one of the primary drivers is the accessibility of telemedicine abortion. COVID precipitated some changes in the FDA regulations around mifepristone, which is one of the two drugs of the medication abortion regimen, and said that it could be mailed. And so Over the past couple years, there have been telehealth providers who are able to evaluate patients online and write prescriptions and send the medication to them to take in their homes. And there are what are known as shield law providers who are clinicians in blue states that have passed these shield law protections who are still serving patients in all 50 states. And so because of the advances in telemedicine, which now make up, I believe, 1 in 5 abortions in the U.S., abortion is more accessible in some ways, in many ways, than it was before the Dobbs decision. I think another factor is the kind of abortion fund ecosystem and the way that they are supporting people traveling out of state. So between 2020 and 2023, the numbers of abortion seekers who have left their state, who have traveled out of state to access care, has doubled. And abortion funds have dispensed tens of millions of dollars to enable them to go access care elsewhere. And so I think that that has been something that's been really powerful and inspiring to see. Because we know throughout history that making abortion illegal or trying to ban it does not make it go away. People will find other ways to access the care that they need. And one of the things that's so powerful about medication abortion and telemedicine is that it means that people kind of have more options than ever to access abortion in a way that is convenient and doesn't necessarily require them to travel out of state. But at the same time, while we know that medication abortion is very safe and effective and for some people can be convenient, it's not a good fit for everyone. There will always be people who need or want clinic-based care. And depending on the state that they're in, the legal environment can be really kind of tenuous and risky. And so people are just making the best decisions that they can, the best choices that they can with the resources that are available to them.
We just have a minute to go, but one of the powers of your book, Rebecca, In Access, is the women who are really leaders of the movement. You talked about shield laws. Tell us about Dr. Linda Prine and the fact that it was Brazil women, women in Brazil, who realized that this, that an off-use of the ulcer drug, the medication abortion drugs, was abortion.
Yeah, I mean, the two drugs, both mifepristone and misoprostol. So misoprostol can be used on its own to induce an abortion. And as you said, it was registered as an ulcer medication. And so in the 1980s in Brazil, which had an abortion ban and really high rates of complications and maternal mortality, through word of mouth, women started realizing that they could take this drug like in the community. They could just buy it from local pharmacies and they could safely and effectively end their pregnancies. And I think that there's this really something I try to draw in the book is this connection, this legacy of just individuals and activists over the years who have tried to share this information as broadly and widely and make it as accessible as possible. And I think that Dr. Linda Prine and other shield law providers who have really been incredibly active in trying to carry on that legacy, really, and make medication abortion accessible to people in all 50 states and around the world.
We're going to talk more about these cases and about Dr. Rebecca Gompers, Women Waves, the organization that has fought to get women the medication abortion drugs around the world, especially in places where there are bans on abortion. We're going to talk with Rebecca Grant after the show and post it as a web exclusive online at democracynow.org. Rebecca Grant is author of the new book, Access: Inside the Abortion Underground and the 60-Year Battle for Reproductive Freedom. Her book before that was called Birth. Coming up, the case of Andre Jose Hernandez Romero, a gay makeup artist and asylum seeker from Venezuela, who has spent over 100 days locked up in El Salvador's mega prison, SECAT, after being sent there by the Trump administration. We'll speak with his mother and his best friend. Stay with us.
Comparsa. se quedan mudos. Otros tienen memoria para olvidar. Si la violencia es un espejo que se rompe.
Nunca Más by La Santa Cecilia in our Democracy Now! Studio. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. It's Pride Month. This weekend, major celebrations will be taking place all over the country. Well, this week also has marked over 100 days since Andre Jose Hernandez Romero and over 200 others were sent on a plane without warning or due process to El Salvador. They were not deported, but rather sent to El Salvador to be confined in a notorious mega prison known as SECAT, the Terrorism Confinement Center, where they have no ability to communicate with the outside world, including with their families or legal counsel. The Trump administration's paying the Bukele government of El Salvador to hold Andre and the others in SECAT. We believe something like $6 million. While they've been described by the administration as the worst of the worst, in fact, the majority of those sent to SECAT have no serious criminal history. Andre and others have been accused of being a member of the Tren de Aragua gang and sent to El Salvador under the Alien Enemies Act. He's now the lead plaintiff in the case JGG versus Trump, which is seeking the return of Andre and all the men unlawfully sent to El Salvador under this act. Andre is a makeup artist. He came to the U.S. to seek asylum, but he never set foot in the country and never had a chance to plead his case. He was immediately placed in immigration detention here in the U.S., reportedly because of a tattoo he has of a crown. He spent months in detention before he was sent to El Salvador. Andre's family has not heard from him since March, before he boarded the flight. He told his mother he was being flown home to Venezuela. She only found out he was, in fact, in the Salvador prison when he never arrived home. And a week later, saw images on the news from SECAT, including of her son. We're going to go right now to a clip.
He was a soy gay and saying that he was innocent. And he was, you know, being slapped every time he would speak up, but he just, like, he couldn't help himself. Then he started praying and calling out, literally crying for his mother. His crying out for his mother really, you know, touched me.
That was Philip Helsinger, who is a photographer who took a photo of Andres with his hair being cut as he cried out for his mother. We're joined now by Margaret Cargioli, who is representing Andre, as well as eight others as their immigration attorney. She's the directing attorney of the policy and advocacy at Immigrant Defenders Law Center. Thanks for coming in from New Jersey. Explain what's happened. Where is he?
Unfortunately, it's been 105 days since over 200 men, including Andre, were disappeared from the United States to El Salvador and to SECAT. Immigration attorneys have not been able to have any direct contact with Andre. His family was not able to see him, and they've not been able to speak with him directly. Since they were sent there, we have been fighting in immigration court to keep his case alive, but unfortunately, in many of these cases, the immigration judges have dismissed their cases, essentially closing them, even though we've argued that their due process rights were violated. They were in the middle of their immigration proceedings, and these cases should continue to stay alive because they should be returned to have their right to defend their cases, seek asylum, and keep their temporary protective status, for example.
I want to go to Andre's mother and his best friend. On Wednesday evening, Democracy Now! Reached Andre Hernandez Romero's mother, Alexis Romero, and his best friend, Reina Cardenas. They were speaking from Andre's hometown in Venezuela of Capacho. Reina went with some people recently, family members of those held in SECAT, to El Salvador to try to meet with Andres, but They were denied that ability. Dina filed a petition to visit Andriy, languishing in Sakat without any communication for over 3 months now. Her petition denied. Andriy's loved ones continue to demand for his release and immediate proof he's still alive, and they haven't been able to speak to him since